The book of Exodus, excuse me, begins with naming the 12 sons of Israel who were enslaved in Egypt. Now, the Egyptian army, to go anywhere north, had to go through Canaan because it's desert to the east. So that was the corridor leading up to the Hittites in Turkey or to any other groups up in the north. So they would have brought back prisoners of war, slaves, all the time. So it's quite likely, in fact it's probably inevitable, that there would have been members of each of these tribes who were slaves in Egypt. Excuse me. But as it stands, as the story develops and it goes on, it's like we were all slaves in Egypt. I was just thinking this morning, it might be a bit like saying Australia fought alongside New Zealand in Gallipoli. We somehow identify with the soldiers that we weren't all at Gallipoli, of course. Not every family was represented there. But somehow it's become a story that we all identify with. So we say, yes, we were there fighting the Turks in Gallipoli. But to begin with the 12, 12 is really quite, it's an artificial number when you talk about the tribes of Canaan. Who knows how many there were. But 12 is a very good number because it was observed, and they picked this up from the east, Babylon and these places, that the sun goes through the constellations in the movement of a year, and there are 12 of them, that 12 identified units of stars. So 12 became, and still remained, a symbol for fullness, completion, from heaven point of view. Not earth, but the heavens, of course, reveal God. They presumed that the stars were living. In fact, that was presumed right through till the modern era. Earth, air, fire and water. These were fire. These were the most pure living creatures. We're a mixture. But they were pure fire. So they're angelic, inverted commas, the stars, live, gazing on the earth. So your star sign was particularly important because you were born under the gaze of these living heavenly beings that were somehow influencing your life. So by talking about the 12 tribes, it's talking about the fullness. So since there were 12 tribes in slavery in Egypt, it says we all needed redemption. And I'm going to spend 20 minutes more probably just reflecting on that idea of everybody needing redemption. Everybody needing to be freed from slavery, not necessarily prison or external slavery, though that goes on, but a lot of slavery, as you know, comes from within. So we'll take you through that journey. Paul says in his chapter 3 of the Romans, all, both Jews and Greeks, and by Greeks he means everybody else who's not a Jew, because Greek was the language spoken through the Roman Empire at that time. All, both Jews and Greeks, are under the power of sin. There's no one who doesn't need to be redeemed. The gospel, he says in Romans 1:16, the gospel is the power of God for salvation to everyone who has faith. And I'll explain later, Paul means the faith of Jesus given to us as a gift. He's not talking about, well, he is talking about our faith, but our faith is Jesus' faith into which we're baptized, given as a gift to us. So we're sharing in his priesthood, we're sharing in his love, we're sharing in his prayer, we're sharing in his faith. To the Jews first, but also to the Greeks. So it was the power of God redeeming us in Jesus. Well, that's not in the book of Exodus, of course, but you can see where the language comes from the early part of the book of Exodus. We all need liberation. Is a more modern word than redemption. Redemption means buying back. It was used precisely of slaves. Let's look at the Gospel of Mark, which is the Peter's Gospel and probably the first of the Gospels. And Mark goes through underlining or highlighting the different ways. It's a catechism. It's not a chronological record. It's a catechism. And they were a storytelling people too, by the way. They inherited this. It's much different in the New Testament because Jesus' ministry only went for 2 or 3 years. It wasn't like the vast Old Testament. And it was written soon after Jesus' death. The earliest part of the New Testament, which is, I suggest, Paul's letter to the Galatians, was only 15 years after the crucifixion. So that's not 15 years. We can all remember back that. It seems like yesterday. So this is a much shorter period, so there's much more factual stuff in it, and memory and all that. There's less oral tradition, but it's all remembered stuff that people could check. But Mark still presents it all. Now look at what he does about how I need, you need, we need to be redeemed. The first scene is the man with an unclean spirit in the synagogue. That's Mark chapter 1, verse 23, and you know the story, I won't repeat it to you, but the Jews, you couldn't come to the synagogue if you were a sinner, you couldn't come to the temple if you were a sinner, only the pure were allowed in the presence of God. If they took that seriously, no one would have been there, but anyhow, they didn't, and they thought they were pure and others weren't. So if you were lame or blind or deaf or sick in any way, they presumed, go back to what I said earlier, that God's organising everything, so God must have made you blind. And if God made you blind, you must have sinned, you or your parents, as they say in John's Gospel. Who sinned? Him or his parents? And Jesus says, you got it all wrong. But they had it wrong. So that's still going on in the New Testament times, this image of God that Jesus had to shatter. So but in this story, there is a man with an unclean spirit. God knows what it was. Medically, we haven't got enough evidence, but you can make your guesses. But they understood sickness to be something to do with the body, of course. But they also thought, we know better, but if you're sick in your mind, it looks like it's something to do with the spirit. It's something else. It's a kind of a demonic possession, because obviously you're irrational and all that, and it doesn't look physical, it looks spiritual, doesn't it? So that's what they presumed. So this man had some kind of a spirit that made him sick. We'd say sick, they say possessed, but it's the same physical reality. Then the second story is, and Jesus heals him. Rather, Jesus' teaching heals him. That's very explicit in the text. 5 times it talks about his teaching. They were amazed at him because he taught with authority. What's he teaching? He's teaching about God. And this story, this event, this the man who was defective, disturbed, Jesus' teaching was so powerful that it brought him peace of mind. It wouldn't do it to everyone, but it did to him. And the peace of mind showed. So there was Jesus' beautiful teaching about God would probably heal most of us, of at least of our bung ideas, of our spiritual sickness. The second one is Simon's mother-in-law. And you could look at that from different aspects, but the key point that Mark makes is that she was healed and she got up and ministered to Jesus and the apostles. It's the first time we have that word deacon, diakoneo, it's the verb here. She ministered to them. So Mark is saying healing is for ministry, it's for you and me, but it's for ministry. It's so that we can serve others, so that we can be instruments of God's love. So that's what healing is about. The third scene is the leper. Beautiful story. Now, he probably wasn't a leper, what we call leprosy, Hansen's disease, because leprosy didn't exist in the middle. It did begin to exist at the time of Jesus. But the Naaman, for example, in the Old Testament, didn't have leprosy. It didn't exist in this part of the world till it was brought back by the soldiers from India with Alexander the Great. So it's some kind of skin, virulent skin thing that they had that got white patches on the body, and when it showed, and they were scared of it, taboo, they didn't understand it, and it was somehow contagious, so they were careful of that. But they also presume God did it, and because of the patches, it looked, this is I think the key point behind it, it looked like death. It looked like a death thing. And so fear of death meant fear of, inverted commas, leprosy, lepra, this thing. So a man who was, okay, comes to Jesus, you know the story, it's beautiful, and he says to Jesus, you could heal me if you want to. And we're not told, but it's likely that Jesus got a surprise. He probably, well, he'd never done it before, so he probably didn't know he could do it. I don't know what he knew and what he didn't know, but he probably didn't know. The way you didn't know you could do things till your gift was seen by someone. I said, you'd be a marvellous reader. You've got a very good reading voice. Oh, have I? Yeah, you could be. And so you get up and read and everyone says, that was beautiful. But so we learn from our mum and dad and teachers who we are. Jesus learnt who he was from people too. Clearly he was like us in everything except sin. So it's not surprising that he probably said, well, of course I want to. And he hugged him and then somehow says immediately, but everything happens immediately in Mark, he's sent off to the priests and he comes back and he's welcomed back into the family. So whatever it was that he had, love, welcome, he was brought back into the community. But you need to know, if you're reading that story, that God says, inverted commas, Leviticus chapter 13, it was God that said, say the writers, but they're the same kind of groups that are writing Exodus. God says if someone has leprosy, they're to go outside, you're not allowed to touch them, they've got to cover their mouth, they've got to cry unclean, unclean, ring a bell, you know, all that stuff, so that they wouldn't be anywhere near people. This is God. So you can imagine the poor man, when he got leprosy, he was told by everybody, this is God's punishment. You must have done something wrong. And he probably, everyone's done something wrong, so they probably exaggerated in his own mind. And so he's not only kicked out from the community, and he won't see his wife and kids again, God's kicked him out, do you get it? But when he sees Jesus, it tells you a lot about Jesus, that sin. He sees Jesus and he's, something in him says, this beautiful person is always talking about God. He's got a different idea of God from all these others, and I reckon he'll welcome me. So he dared to break the law. Jesus also dared to break the law by hugging the man, because you're not allowed to. God says, no, he doesn't. It was said to you of old, but I say to you. You're getting it, I'm sure. You probably already got it. But that's a wonderful thing, and Jesus welcomes him back into the community. Then there's the bridegroom takes precedence over fasting. Everybody fasts. Well, you got to, because otherwise the neighbours will tell you, you know, well, you didn't fast. So everybody's, some cultures are like that. If everyone does it, they've got to do it. There's not much room for freedom. And that can be good and can be bad. So they're all fasting, all right? But the apostles aren't fasting on a fast day. And Jesus isn't fasting either. They're getting stuff and nibbling at it as they walk through because they're hungry. And the Pharisees say, look what you're doing, you're breaking, and they can point to the text in the Bible that says you must fast on this day, it's all there. And Jesus says, what do you mean? I mean, and he tells them, why would people fast when the bridegroom's with them? And they probably thought, what's that got to do with fasting? Because it hasn't got anything to do with it, apparently. But look what it tells you about Jesus. His understanding is, it's about love. He saw God as the bridegroom, not the punishing legislator. That comes from human stuff, legislation. We do the best we can. We need law and order. But don't blame God for it, for heaven's sake. So we've got all this, and you know that from John's Gospel. He even begins with a marriage feast at Cana for the same reasons, to say, wait a minute, if you're going to be religious, real religious, yeah, nothing wrong with fasting. But there's much more important things to do than follow these rituals. You must know that you're loved by God. Get that into your head and then go ahead with the rest. But if you don't get that, religion is just a burden. I don't think any of us would agree with that. Jesus talks about the messianic banquet and so on. Matthew, that lovely thing that you might know by Caravaggio, where Jesus is in there and he's got... And Matthew's over there, I've got a picture of it here. Matthew's over there going, me? And he's got one hand on the money, the other hand saying, what are you calling me for? Because the blokes that are with Jesus are all fishermen. And these, I'm Matthew, I've been robbing them hand and foot for about 5 years. They're not going to welcome me. What do you want me for? But he does. So he calls Matthew. And then what happens? Matthew throws a party. But of course, the only friends of Matthew's are either tax collectors or prostitutes. Sorry to say. So if Jesus is going to have a party, he better have it with tax collectors and prostitutes, all this, because otherwise there's nobody there. Because no one else is going to come to his place to have a feed. And Jesus dining with sinners? But you read in the Psalms, morning prayer often enough. I don't eat with sinners, says the psalmist, very proud of himself. Why don't you eat with sinners? Or who do you think you are? There's a lot of questions you could ask the psalmist for that. Then the Sabbath, the most sacred day, and it's a wonderful practice that the Jews have got. We've got to learn from them. If we're going to have ecumenical movement, and we must have, the most important ecumenical movement would have to be Christianity and Judaism to come together. That's the great tragedy of the overwhelming Greek church and the Jewish Christians becoming less and less, and then the destruction of Jerusalem and all, you know, the story, and the dreadful story, nothing to do with religion, but the fear and the money people, you know, they're robbing me and they're taking my jobs. People coming into Australia as migrants, they'll take our jobs. Everybody knows they create jobs because they set up their own... the Vietnamese kind of coffee shop or some damn thing, and everyone's going there because they like their food. But no, no, they're taking our jobs. They're creating jobs, for heaven's sake. So, but we get loaded with this stuff from the newspapers all the time. They're straight out lies, because the people writing them must know better, but they're playing on our fear for their own benefit. And we, unfortunately, fear is something that can grip us, and we can act out of that fear. And in the recent papers, they're all on it. They're all on it, and the stuff from the thing. And Morrison is now like Nelson, winning the war at sea. What do you mean the war at sea? Poor people in leaky boats and the poor Navy being told... Anyhow, we'll go on and on. But this is not unrelated to today, surely. And Jesus says, go on, you blokes. The Sabbath... Men, people, weren't made for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was made for us. All the laws of the church in Acts are all about us living to the full. Every single one of them is a gift to tell us how to live to the full. In fact, when I was teaching at Chevalier, just up the road here, 40 years ago, I used to put on the blackboard every lesson, because they were all rugby union players rather than students. If there's any of them here, tell me. But they were, like that was a big thing in the colleges, and some of them might have been students. I don't think too many were. But I used to write on the board, I've come that you may live and live to the full. This is Jesus' statement. And I used to say to the boys, if anything I tell you here in class doesn't sound like it's about life to the full, attack me, because I'm not telling it properly, or you're not getting it, you know. Because it is about life to the full. Celibacy for the priesthood is about living life to the full. Now, whether it's wise, pardon me, it isn't wise, but anyhow, the church is still sticking to this thing about priests and celibacy, even though you're up in the islands, they can't get communion, they can't get mass. Half the world can't get mass because there's not enough priests. So we stick to this man-made thing. For sake. I mean, it's sinful, it's stupid, but we're stupid. So we just keep piling the stuff up. And right. Well, he says, look, the Sabbath is for us. It's for you. It's to help you love God. It's to help you live a beautiful life. So there's all that liberation stuff. That's liberated from cult and law and anything else. So it's a central message. Here's John 8:32. He says, "You'll know the truth." And the truth in the New Testament always means who God really is. That's the truth. It's not talking about an argument and a syllogistic thing and right conclusions. The truth is, this is who God is. Jesus is the revelation of God. So if you've got any ideas about God, says Paul to his communities, that don't fit with Jesus, and Paul's saying, I had plenty, but I got rid of them. So I want you to get rid of them too. All your ideas of God that don't fit with Jesus are simply wrong. Look at him, learn from him, learn who God is, learn the truth, and the truth will set you free. And in chapter 8, verse 36, John says, if the Son makes you free, S-O-N, if Jesus makes you free, then, mate, you've got real freedom. That's what freedom is. And no one can take that from you, that you are loved by God. Mary of Magdala, you're loved by God. Thief on the cross, you're loved by God. Leper, you're loved by God. Freedom. Nothing else will give it. There are 12 apostles for the same reason. Because 12 is representing the whole divine providence. Now, Jesus went to the mountain to pray, spent the night in prayer to God. And when day came, he called his disciples and chose 12 of them. And he chose the ones that he was inspired to choose by God. That's why he prayed. And he called them apostles, because they'd go out on mission. So Judas must have been a fantastic leader with immense potential. Jesus, and if you've got this idea, I'm about to knock it out of your head. Are you ready? If you've got any idea in your head that Jesus knew that Judas was going to betray him in 3 years' time and he needed him to fit into the plan of God, can you hear what terrible things I'm saying? If that's what you think, then Jesus is phony. Jesus chose him because he had leadership and love and courage. But sadly, you can have leadership, love and courage and not listen. He didn't like the humility side of Jesus. He didn't like Jesus losing. In fact, he was so sure Jesus would win that he created the clash, knowing that Jesus would win. And when Jesus didn't win, inverted commas, Judas was shocked, amazed, despaired, threw the money back. He didn't do it for money. Chucked the money back and unfortunately went out and hanged himself. But when Jesus had, he never forgot Jesus' hug in the garden. He couldn't. How could you? So you'd have to be certain. All these jokes about Peter being at the pearly gates, it's actually Judas. He's at the pearly gates. He's saying, come in, mate. I know how you feel. Heaven's for you. He drags them in because he knew from you. Whatever. I don't know any of that, and you know I don't know. But I'm quite willing to say it because how could it be any other way? If the last connection you had with Jesus, he hugged you and called you friend, who's going to forget that? Even if you're despairing. So he chose the 12. Talks about them sitting on 12 thrones. Well, if you don't take that literally, for God's sake, there aren't thrones in heaven. They'd come straight out through the clouds. They're too heavy. And the apocalypse, the wall of the city had 12 foundations. On them are the 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. And by the way, every time you read in the New Testament anything that involves the 12, that is all-encompassing, it's meant for everybody. It's not meant just for the bishops. 12, and then the bishops come along, and where are you? Nowhere? No. The bishops are terribly important, God help us. And they've got a wonderful role in the church. So are mothers, terribly important, and they've got their role in the church. So are teenage big sisters and big brothers, got wonderful. And we all share the priesthood of Christ, don't we? Have you ever been to a baptism? Priest, prophet, and king. So we're all different ways. We've got to do it our way, our unique gift. So the 12 is always completely comprehensive, Catholic, all-involving. And each of us has to find how to do that our way, the way we're gifted by God. Now, in case you didn't think freedom was important, I'm taking it to what I think is Paul's earliest letter. It's a minority opinion, but if you ever got round to reading what I think my best commentary, if I could be humble enough to say that, because best doesn't mean any of them are good. It just means it's the best of them. And that's the one on Paul. Very big, thick thing. Trouble is it costs $50, but it has to. I pay $50 to buy it, so I have to charge $50 to sell it, or I'll go down the gurgle. Well, in there I argue the point, minority opinion, but I find my own arguments very convincing. That it's his earliest letter, because it had to be written, and read it if you like. There's a book there, you can open and read it without buying it. It had to be written before the Council of Jerusalem, or it makes no sense. Because the main argument that Paul had with the Galatians, the Jewish Christians that were going into Galatia and into Antioch, and we've got evidence of both of that, the main reason, main argument he could have said was, we agreed at the Council of Jerusalem that the Gentiles don't have to be circumcised. He doesn't say that in the letter to the Galatians. And he's building up an argument precisely for that point. Why did he leave out his trump card? Because he hadn't paid cards yet. It's written before that council. It's got to be. So if it is, it's 48 AD, 15 years after the crucifixion of Jesus. And chapter 1, verse 4, we're at the beginning of the New Testament, reads, Christ gave himself to set us free. I need to be freed, you need to be freed, everybody needs to be freed from stuff inside and stuff outside. And I'm waiting for a bishop. I can say all these things now because I'm over 75, and so I can, you know, smile and say it. It's not a positive change. I have to do it. Not only because I'm over 75, there'd be other reasons why I wouldn't make much of a bishop. But anyhow, that's the fact. I want a bishop to put under his... Break every yoke. Oh, he'd be a brave bishop. But we need brave bishops. Break every yoke. That would sound to me like Jesus. You'd get crucified for sure. Means all the yokes that are on people, break them. You know, this argument that's going on at the moment in Europe. The Germans, thank God, are saying, look, people who've been divorced and remarried should be welcomed at the Eucharist because they're hungry. And Pope says, you know, the Eucharist is not a prize for the perfect. It's for the weak. It's for those who need Jesus. And you can see, you know, and our dear old Cardinal Pell's written the introduction to a book by five bishops, cardinals, including the one who runs the doctrine of the faith. You're arguing that now we've got to stick the hard line. And beautiful Peter Day, who's a priest in Canberra, lovely young man, lovely priest, he sent me an email. Oh, it's so powerful. He says, look, we don't quite know what Jesus would do, but we know this. And he quotes, you know, from the New Testament. Absolutely, you can't argue against it. So I said, oh, for God's sake, don't just give it to me. Give it to the Pope. Send it to everybody you can so they can see that people are thinking. Break every yoke. Is it? Yeah. Well, Christ came to break every yoke. Come to me, he said. Take my yoke upon you. It's the yoke of love that's shared, for I'm gentle and humble in heart. We must stop putting boundaries on the action of God's liberating and life-giving spirit. They're my words, they're good enough though. We've got to stop putting boundaries on the action of God's liberating and life-giving spirit. Now, priests are doing it all the time not everyone is, some are too scared to, but priests are doing this all the time in pastoral ministry. But wouldn't it be lovely if the church told us we could do it? Do you know what I mean? Otherwise you're doing it, but you're doing it. But you're doing it with a bit of an effort and without anyone's approval. By their fruits you know. Jesus was crucified in 33. Paul's encounter with him was probably the next year or within a year after Jesus' death. That's highly likely, the year 34. And he talks about the gospel that he received from Jesus. Well, it's a mystical experience of Jesus, but he got it from people around him too. Remember when he went to Damascus and the street called Straight, and everyone was scared of Paul because he was such a firebrand, and he was against the Christians because they were claiming divinity for a bloke from Nazareth whom the high priest had condemned to death. What are you talking about? He was a loyal Jew. And then something happened to him. I think it was the stoning of Stephen would have had a big effect on him. To be there when Stephen was stoned and to see Stephen loving so intensely. Another thing that happened when he went to Damascus, and they all the Christians were scared stiff because they'd already lost some family because of him. A dear old bloke, when you get old, you can do anything. So pray that you get old one day. The old bloke, Ananias, said, "I'll go." And he goes along and clambers up the steps to see Paul and has a bit of a chat with Paul and says, "I think you should be baptised." And then baptises him. Isn't that good? He didn't go through the RCIA program. He didn't go for 4 years to some college somewhere, and he didn't get tested. He saw something in Paul that was baptisable. So he baptised him, which means he welcomed him into the community. And then he went into the community, started to preach about God, except Jesus being God, you know, and all. Anyhow, that's the revelation he had. He got it from people, he got it from prayer, he got it from a good, honest young man who just was taught badly till he met the real Christians. God called me through his grace and was pleased to reveal his Son in me. Sometimes it's translated to me. It's not impossible because prepositions in Greek as a second language, which is Hellenistic Greek, get a bit wobbly. But the actual thing is en in Greek. So maybe Paul meant in me. That's the way it's translated by John Chrysostom. And there's a tradition of translating it that way, and it seems to me better. He revealed his Son to me, yeah, but he revealed his Son in me, just as he revealed his Son in Ananias. And in Mary and Martha and the mother and the beloved disciple, so that I might proclaim him among the non-Jews. And he was perfectly fitted for that, Paul, because he was taught in Tarsus. He was a Stoic philosopher. He was taught by Gamaliel in Jerusalem. He was the one who was able to bridge. And we need people today to bridge. Every generation needs them, but we need them to bridge the gap between the Catholic world of my youth and my family, which was totally beautiful, with today's hungering and thirsting in the World Wide Web, and the questions they're asking that the church isn't answering. They're not getting it from the pulpit often. And it's that, no blaming any pulpit, but that's not what's happening. So that we're saying some of the things we said 40 years ago, and we're using words that don't connect. Any wonder the kids are bored? They're not connected. So we're all got to end this, and we've got to help each other do it. And if any of you are a Shakespearean poet, for God's sake, get to it. Don't sit around watching Days of Our Lives if it still exists. Write a drama. Write something that's about Jesus. And don't make it like the Passion of Christ of that... Who was the bloke? Who? Mel Gibson, yes. Some people said they liked it, and I said, "Did you watch it?" And they said, "Yeah." Remember the end of it. God sends this thing down. God wins in the end. And the whole bloody place is blasted to smithereens. Good triumphs over evil, like America in Iraq. That's the kind of image. Holy smoke. The God of love? I mean, what are they talking about? It was a wonderful film showing us the terror of Roman torture, if that interests you, and it was good. But it didn't get Jesus right, and it didn't get God right, and it didn't get life right. How dare people like it? Okay. Paul escapes from Damascus, etc., and he goes to Jerusalem, and dear old Barnabas introduces him to Jerusalem, and they're all saying, "Oh my God, what are you bringing Paul here for?" into our, you know, into our catacomb or something. What do you bring? And he speaks there, and then he wasn't there that long, and he must have been too hard to live with, or he was still a bit brash. Conversion comes slowly. Some of us haven't got there yet. Any of you converted people, tell me how to do it and I'll try. But so Paul was still a bit, and probably he was causing as much trouble as anything else. So they said, Paul, look, go home. He went back to Tarsus. We're talking about the year 37. In the year 45, that's what, 8 years later, Barnabas still believes in Paul. And he goes up and brings him back to Antioch. What was Paul doing in those 8 years? I don't know. Nobody knows. He wasn't doing much as far as anything goes. He was, because there's no record of anything, he was probably trying to sort it all out for himself, trying to get it right, trying to understand, praying, whatever. But it took him 8 years before he became a teacher of the faith in Antioch. He goes back to Jerusalem and he only meets Peter and John and James in the Christian community. And then they go on their first missionary journey. Barnabas leads the way, and Barnabas has a cousin, young Mark, who's probably the author of the Gospel. And Paul comes along to help Barnabas. And where do they go? They go to Barnabas's home place, which is Cyprus. Of course, that's where you go. You go where you're known. And they meet the Roman governor of Cyprus, was a man whose surname was Paul. Up till then in the Acts, we call him Saul. That was his Jewish name, Saul. Saul Bar, whatever his father's name was, we don't know. So he was. That's who he was. But after here, after Cyprus, he's called Paul. Of course, he's called by his surname, not his Christian name, like Beethoven and Mozart, and we call them all by their surnames. Anybody... So Paul was his surname. He was Saul Paul. But Paul was the name of the governor. So it looks likely that the governor gave him his name so that he'd be protected and known that he was under the protection of... And not only that, where did he go? He went to Antioch in the middle of Turkey, which is where the governor came from. Now, it doesn't tell us, but he probably said, look, I've got a brother in Antioch and his wife is a great cook. And you go there and they'll give you a good entry. They'll look after you. So Paul said, oh, okay, and probably had a letter from the governor. We don't know the full story, but make it human. So that's where he goes. And it may be a coincidence that the governor had the name Paul and that the governor came from Antioch. But it looks to me like a bit of human stuff going on there. So that's where he goes. And they went off. Well, you needn't read that because I've just told you that story. There's the journey. You know where the first journey of Paul was. He started here in Antioch. They went down here. That's where he met the governor. Then he went to Perga. Then he went up to Antioch. Then he came to Iconium, Lystra, Derbe. Then he journeyed back. And by the way, on his journey back, he appointed presbyters. They need... Priest is the same word. It's just a collapsing of the word presbyter. So priest. He made priests because they need the Eucharist and they need life and they need someone to run the place. And the Jewish community were run by presbyters, so he just does the same system. They wouldn't have all been Jews, but many of them were. So he just follows that. But again, he puts a leader there. There should be a leader in every parish in Australia. They're already waiting there and they could celebrate the Eucharist. Given authority to do so. Men, women, married, single. What's the problem? Let's get leaders. If Muslim countries can have leaders who are women, why can't the church? Has anyone got any ideas? Help me. But it will happen. But we've got to be, we're not so much patient as hopeful. So he does that and then he goes home and tells them all about it. And this is Paul's words quoted by Luke, who's writing the speeches. But Luke was a historian, the only historian in the New Testament. So he checked his sources. By this, says Paul, Jesus, by this Jesus, everyone who believes is set free. Here it is again, freedom. From all those sins from which you could not be freed by the law of Moses. The law of Moses was a whole lot of signposts telling you what's wrong and what's right. Good-o. So I'm in a car going to Darwin up through the desert, and I've run out of petrol, and there's a signpost that says Darwin this way, 1,200 kilometres. Adelaide this way. That's great. I'm so pleased to know what the direction is we're going in, but I've got no petrol. So what am I going to do? Probably got no water either. So the trouble with the law was it pointed the way, but it didn't give you the energy to do it. So Paul says, no, Jesus will give you the energy to do it. He'll give you his spirit. He'll make it possible for you to do whatever the law requires and a lot more. Now we're told by the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 15, certain individuals came down from Judea, down, they're going north, but Judea's high up, and got it, and they were teaching the brothers, these are Christians, good people, went through a good seminary, they just got badly taught, that's all. Unless you're circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you can't be saved. Paul has just been telling them, if you're a Jew, get circumcised. It's good. It's part of your thing. If you're not a Jew, you don't have to. And then these mob come and say, I'll report you to the cardinal. So this is all going on. And that's real stuff. And they also went to Galatia, obviously. Oh, what happened there? Obviously, I pressed the wrong button, but you put me up. The Galatians know that they can fall back. They're insecure. They're just new Christians. So they can lose the freedom that they experience. They know they can. So this group comes in, and that can happen in any group. They say, look, the way to keep yourself free is to put your left foot there, your right foot there. There's the fence. Don't do that. Do this. Don't do that. And they can set up a system which can create clones that'll go on forever and never put a foot wrong because they never put a foot anywhere. That's one system. Another system is to believe in people. Believe in children. Love them. Michelangelo, in the yard at Florence, there was a bit of marble broken from the mountain. Carrara marble, perfect, beautiful, but broken. It fell off the mountain in an awkward position, so it was shapeless. And no one knew what to do with it. Michelangelo looked at it, and apparently eventually he saw in this piece of marble something that needed to come out. And when he saw it, not before, but when he saw it, he then, an artist could do it, he chipped away to reveal what was there to his artistic sign. And he produced David, one of the most wonderful masterpieces of the world. But that's what mums have to do, teachers have to do. Priests have to do, missionaries have to do. Look at people with contemplative eyes, believing that they're specially graced by God, each of them. And if we can't see what their gift is, keep out of it. Let someone else do it. Let Uncle Jack do it. Or let Dad do it, or Mum do it, or somebody else. But don't do it yourself, because if you start chipping away, there are people who will chip away your strength, because it looks like a vice. You're too damn forward. Paul was too damn forward, and thanks be to God he was, because he ripped through the world preaching Christianity. Do you know what I'm kind of getting at? Our gifts can often be the edgy bits. And Jesus says that in the parable too. Don't pull out the weeds, you blokes. You're leaving there. Let God do that. You just keep planting wheat and doing your best and wait to the harvest. Let God do that. Let life do the other. So the circumcision group had strong arguments to persuade them to obey God's will as found in the law, because the Old Testament says you've got to be circumcised. God said. Paul didn't disagree with this, but he had come to see that the law had come to its flowering in Jesus. To obey the law means join the Christian community. Join this, and that's about freedom. He writes from Antioch to Galatia, Paul, an apostle, we saw this, sent neither by human commission nor human authorities, but through Jesus Christ and God the Father who raised him from the dead, and all the members of God's family who are with me to the churches of Galatia. Grace to you and peace from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ, who gave himself. That's what love is, the gift of self. It's nothing else. It's the gift of oneself. He gave himself for our sins to set us free from the present evil age according to the will of God the Father. This was God's will that Jesus revealed what liberation really is about. I'm astonished, says Paul, that you are so quickly deserting the one who called you in the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel. It might be in the book. Not that there's another gospel, but there are some who are confusing you. They want to pervert the gospel of Christ. And the word taraso in Greek, which is translated confusing there, means they're introducing fear into your relationship with your Abba, God. And fear will bring about conformity, but it won't bring about freedom. And the whole Christian journey is about freedom. Not freedom to do what you want, freedom to do what the Spirit inspires you to do. A beautiful text, and very important text in Paul, and it is about freedom. The whole book of Exodus is about freedom. That's why I'm delaying on it, I hope not too long. We've come to believe, says Paul in Galatians 2:15, in Christ Jesus. In Christ Jesus is 100 times in Paul's letters. He's always saying it. Everything's in him. So that we might be justified. And your translation, your Bible, I'd be almost certain, will have by faith in Christ. I believe it is the minority opinion again, but that is the proper translation. In Greek, as in other languages, I'll just talk about Greek, you can have prepositions which clarify things, or you can just have what's called the genitive case. Only the genitive is put here. Faith is a noun, but he's talking about faith that is related to Jesus Christ. That's the faith he's talking about. How is it related? Is it from Jesus, to Jesus, in Jesus, with Jesus? You know, there's all these possibilities in there. Because it's not said. It's just genitive. But if it is just genitive, there's nothing wrong with saying having faith in Jesus. Paul will say that in his other letters. That's not what he's talking about here. He's talking about a much more profound thing than my faith in Jesus. And the problem was the Protestant Reformation, where they thought the Catholic wasn't, but sometimes it was. People were, in fact, that Christianity is a matter of doing this and doing this and doing this and doing good works and earning your way to God. And there was, that opinion was certainly around, but it was never church teaching. But in practice, there was a lot of that going on, selling indulgences, you know, about that. So the Protestants hated that. So they said, no, you're not supposed to do that. What you've got to do is this, believe in Jesus. Something else to do. But they were wrong too. The whole point of Christianity is something we receive. It's a gift. It's given to everyone, by the way. We don't often recognise it, people recognise it in ways we don't know. God isn't just saying, I'll give it to you and I won't give it to you. God gives it to everyone, of course. And what he gives is the faith of Jesus. It's Jesus' faith in God that is gifted to us. Which is a wonderful truth. It's Jesus' prayer which is gifted to us. Jesus' love which is gifted to us. Jesus' everything, patience. So it's the faith of Christ that is given to each of us as we join the Christian community. So it's something we receive and welcome. We've got to welcome it. We've got to say yes, like Mary at the Incarnation. It's not going to be pushed on us. But what we've got to welcome is not a new thing to do, but something to welcome and receive, namely Jesus' beautiful faith in his Father on the cross, in the agony, everywhere. It's not by doing works of the law, because no one will be justified by doing what the law requires. It's a good thing to do, but it won't get you there. I've been crucified with Christ, says Paul. Not literally, but he lost his friends, Jewish friends, Christian friends. He was hounded. And it's no longer I who live. It's now Christ who lives in me. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live, once again, translation will say, by my faith in Christ. Go away. By the faith of the Son of God, loving me now and giving himself for me. So Jesus gives us a share of his priesthood, share of everything. Gives his life to us, his spirit, which is his love for the Father. It's all gift. It's all given. And we've got to welcome it and let it live in us. Galatians is full of it, as you can see. For freedom, he says in chapter 5:1, Christ has set us free. Stand firm and don't submit again to the yoke of slavery. Don't let anyone put a yoke of slavery on you, because in their insecurity they will. Some people are temperamentally geared to putting yokes on other people, but Jesus wasn't. In Christ Jesus, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision counts for anything. It doesn't matter, says Paul. The only thing that matters is faith working through love, which is the perfect sentence that to solve the problem between Catholics and Protestants at the time of Luther. I presume people tried to quote it. The only faith that they're talking about is the faith of Christ given to us as a gift, and if it's really from him, it'll find its expression in love, not in doing things that are right or in love. There it is, Galatians 5:6. You were called to freedom, brothers and sisters, only don't use your freedom as an opportunity for self-indulgence. Through love, become slaves to one another. For the whole law is summed up in the single commandment, you shall love your neighbour as yourself. He gave himself for us to set us free. If Son makes you free, you are indeed free. Just a little bit more. I'm nearly finished. So that's all been about the 12. If we did this, we'd only get through chapter 1. And I do want to do the whole of Exodus with you. Chapter 1, verses 9 to 11 reads, the Israelites, this is impossible, but they said it in the text. The Israelites are more, this is Pharaoh speaking. The Israelites are more numerous and more powerful than we are. Well, I don't think Ramses II didn't think that, nor did his follower, nor did anybody in Egypt. No record of it, no statement of it. Not even another country bragging about it. Oh, look at Israel, they're so weak now. The Israelites are stronger than them. No. So they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labour, a memory, because there were slaves, forced labour, by Ramses II building these places against the sea people. So he used a slave to do it. Many of them would have come from the tribes of Canaan. Then there's the story of the midwives, who they're told to kill all the boys. Why didn't they kill the girls? If they knew a bit about biology, they might have killed the girls. But they killed the boys. Well, boys matter in that world. And they probably didn't know too much biology. So, but the midwives, there were two of them, by the way, for the whole of Egypt, leave that aside. The story is very interesting. And so these midwives were tricky, and they did this, and they kind of pretended not to and didn't know. And poor old Pharaoh, with all his power, couldn't beat these two cunning little nurses. And it's a story of ordinary people who revere God to thwart the will of an oppressor. And that's what it captures. And every Jew reading the story would have thought, yeah, we don't have to do what the doctors tell us. We're nurses. We know who's sick and we know what's going on. Give them a tablet or something. Moses, if you remember the story, was put in a, it's called a basket. But this can't be a coincidence. The only other time the word teba is used in the Hebrew Bible, it's talking about the Ark of Noah. Basket. See, we're trying to make it realistic. So we put words in that make sense to people, make the fact more obvious. Wait a minute. Noah, the story of Noah, is not about Noah building a boat so that it can rise above the floodwaters that are covering the whole earth, by the way, even the highest mountain. If water covered the whole earth, including the mountain, we wouldn't be here now. Old Ben Fee would have just collapsed. So there are stories about floods. Of course there were floods. And that's the image. But the flood in the Bible has nothing to do with... It comes out of heaven. It's the waters above. Read Genesis chapter 1. The waters above and the waters below were separated by God by this firmament. It was solid, they thought. The sky. So it was put there like that. The sky collapses. So you're going right back to initial chaos because of human behaviour. That's what the story's about. And Noah builds a church, a temple. The measurements of it are the measurements of a Canaanite temple. He's building a temple. And the temple rises up above the chaos. And out of the temple comes light and life. It's a wonderful story. But if you're an American and you want some money and you're going to look for the Ark, I mean, give it. It's like looking for Cinderella's slipper. So that's... Now, Moses is put in a teba. So it's a sacred place. It's got to be considered sacred. A sacred place, a sanctuary. Then Moses becomes the sacred one cared for by God who then comes and... He makes it, the priest, he goes out fighting. We can't do that, but I'll leave it. You probably know the story. He attempts to impose injustice by violence, but it doesn't work. So he has to go away because liberation, I can't do it, you can't do it. We have to wait on God to do it. So Moses, with all his courage, tries to liberate the people, his own people. A lot of people don't know that. But he can't do it. It won't work. So because it can't work. And then in Exodus 2, 23, the end to 25, God is introduced for the first time into the book of Exodus. After a long time, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned under their slavery and they cried out. Out of the slavery, their cry for help rose up to God. God heard the groaning and God remembered. God hasn't got Alzheimer's or something. But it means, remembered means he turned his attention to this. And he remembered the covenant, book of Genesis, with Abram, Isaac and Jacob. And God looked upon the Israelites and God took notice of them. And there's texts there that bear that out from the rest of the Psalms. It's all over the place. A bit interesting. When Matthew writes his Midrash, he says, these are not facts. Matthew is a storytelling person too. And the first fact in the book of Matthew is the baptism of Jesus. The rest is building up this picture of theology at a high. And he has, take the child and his mother, flee to Egypt. Herod is going to search for the child to destroy him. And he quotes Hosea, out of Egypt I call my son. Jesus is reliving the journey to freedom from slavery. So he's in Egypt. Did Jesus ever go to Egypt? I haven't got the faintest idea. But you haven't either. Because the text isn't telling us that. It's telling us Jesus brought people out of Egypt. Slavery. Got it? To freedom. Promised land. And then there's the massacre of all the boys, just like Pharaoh. Rise up, take the child, go to the land. Those who sought the child's life are dead. That's in Matthew. And then there could be some music, but there won't be because the bell is gone for lunch.